Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. I am your host. Your ghost host. Mwah. 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 M-W-A-H. M-W-A-H. This is a very special Halloween episode of the Nerdist Podcast, which is really only half Halloween-y. This is Neil deGrasse Tyson, and we recorded this several months ago when Neil was shooting episodes of Star Talk for the Nerdist Channel, which premiered November 1st. Nerdist Channel weekly show, Star Talk Radio, now a video show. Some of the shows are in studio, some of the shows are live. The first one is a live show with astronaut Mike Massimino. It's at the Bell House might be in Brooklyn, but also Kristen Schaal's on that episode, and I believe... who else? Oh, Hodgman, I believe, is on the episode, too. So it's an amazing, amazing episode. So check it out, youtube.com/Nerdist. Then click subscribe so you can see Dr. Tyson and Star Talk every week. Because he's smart. He's pretty dang smart. And he's a badass. So that is that business. Then what I'm going to tack on at the end of this episode that you have the option of listening to or not is Liam Lynch was on the episode, was on the podcast a few episodes ago, and he said he had this amazing ghost story. He was like, I've got to come back and tell this ghost story. And I said, okay, we'll do it for Halloween. So that's what he's done. Liam has told this ghost story and sent us the file. It's about 20 minutes long. So you have the option of listening to it at the end if you want to celebrate the Halloween spirit, which you should, because it's the greatest fucking holiday ever. And I'm bummed that it's over tomorrow. But I'm going to enjoy my Halloween burrito. See? I'm going to take my own advice. They're not just words that happen at the end of the podcast. Pumpkin spice. Thank you, Chloe. Yes, I'm going to enjoy my pumpkin spice burrito and all these insane Japanese Kit Kat flavors that we've got. I bought so many crazy Japanese Kit Kats, like blueberry cheesecake and strawberry nut roll, and I kind of made that one up. But there's a lot. Pumpkin pudding is one. Green tea Kit Kats. Oh, Japan, you are so far beyond us in Kit Kat technology and so many other technologies. Let's get it together, America. Let's get it together. Because people are coming here from other countries and taking Kit Kat jobs away from hardworking Americans. America! Sorry, I don't know what just happened. That's my Halloween costume. That's my Halloween costume this year. It's a guy that just says, it's an audio costume. Thank you, Chloe. I appreciate that. What did you say last night when we were talking in the podcast? You're like, I wasn't even born when blah, blah, blah.
Oh, what was the Maximum Overdrive or some?
Oh, yeah, I think I referenced.
Maximum Overdrive.
I referenced.
And I'm like, well, I don't know what that is. And then I looked it up and it turned out that movie came out 2 years before I was born.
Okay, you know what?
Yeah.
Go to your room. No Xbox for a week.
But, I mean, Chris.
Oh, gross. Gross. Way out of bounds.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
I'm going to hire a referee just to blow a whistle at comments like that. Oh, that is horrifying and perfect for Halloween. Happy Creepy Ween, everyone. Mwah. Mwah. Creepy Ween.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We'll be right back. fun to watch you play with a Rubik's Cube a minute ago outside. Are you a Rubik's Cube fanatic?
You're revealing this to people. No, I'm not a fanatic. I when I was in graduate school, when I really should have been studying for graduate exams, the Rubik's Cube would just showed up, and I was committed to solve it. And I didn't want to solve it through anybody's instructions. Mm-hmm. People buy books so they can speed up faster and faster. I've never read a book, but I ultimately solved it like 400 hours later.
Oh, wow.
And the fastest I ever did it was 76 seconds.
Oh, my God.
Well, that was in my day.
Okay.
We all have our day.
Sure.
Surely you had a day when you did something in 76 seconds.
I did, yeah. to the detriment of the young woman I was with.
Okay. But now it just showed up. I mean, I did it once on Jon Stewart. And so now, like, people are sending me Rubik's Cubes. I'm not fanatic about it.
Because there's another Chris Hardwick in the world, and that guy is actually, this is a true story, he's actually a Rubik's Cube champion. And there are videos of other Chris Hardwick solving blindfolded, solving Rubik's Cube with one hand. You go to his website, and he has these, like, crazy theoretical cubes that you have to solve with math, where they're just like, you know, X to the N sided cubes.
So he's crossed over.
He is crossed over.
Here's where I don't boast about my what I can do with a Rubik's Cube. Because online, there's a Korean girl who is 4, sitting in a high chair, solves the Rubik's Cube in 4 minutes.
Hmm.
We're done.
Yeah.
We're done.
You can't follow that.
You can't follow that. Just let. And her hand can't, isn't even big enough to hold the cube. And she solves it in 4 minutes. So I said, this is just a hobby. It's not a.
Is there are there people that can see the logic of the cube and understand how to manipulate three-dimensional space to do their bidding?
Do you see I guess there are, but most people I know who are really good at it just did a lot of reading. Then yeah. I said, what good is that? Then you didn't really solve the puzzle. You found the recipe to solve the puzzle.
The first time I solved it, I had wedged all the pieces out and put them back
together. You can pull them back.
And some people say, well, you didn't solve it. I go, it's a different kind of problem solving.
And I was hoping you wouldn't say you removed the stickers.
No, well, I tried that once, too.
That's also a solution in principle.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not the intended one.
No. Yeah, that's basically just that's the superficial solution, which unfortunately.
Here's the problem. We, in our culture, are breeding people who care more about the answer than the path to the answer.
Of course.
So that we say solve this, they just pull out the stickers, look, it is solved,
mm-hmm.
but they actually have no meaningful solution path to get there.
Right.
Because we don't promote pathways, only the right answer. And that this is a problem. It's shortcoming of our education system.
Because we're impatient. We're impatient and we are addicted to convenience.
Yeah, I'd rather, okay, you're impatient, but the day you actually have to solve something, what do you do? You're stumped.
What you need to do is when you're looking at a black hole, you just need to rearrange the stickers on it. That's the lesson that's learned here. Here's the problem with these planets. You just need to move the stickers around.
No, here it is. No, it's because we also are a multiple choice society.
Right.
And I figured this out, my sister, I said, you know, let's go out to lunch. Where do you want to go? You know her reply was? What are my choices? And I'm thinking, invent something out of your head. Come up with something on your own. Because we only get multiple choices. And if you're about to fall into a black hole, what do you do? Our brain is saying, well, what are my choices?
Mm-hmm.
When maybe the actual answer is a pathway not imagined by the person who gave you the choices to begin with. Maybe you're cleverer than they are.
Interesting.
So if you're ever in that lifeboat and there's only food for 4, but there's 6 people, do you eat the other 2? Do you throw them overboard? Usually you're given a set of choices. My reply to that is, I'm cleverer than the person who set up those choices. I might find another way to create a net, gather fish, so we don't have to eat the other 2 people on the lifeboat.
Sure.
There could be solutions you haven't thought of.
What if one of them looks delicious? Had you thought about?
I hadn't considered that factor. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, I think. But there's also a problem with having, you know, people think they want choices, but then it's stressful when you have too many choices.
Yeah, like we just renovated, and I had to choose the color paint for the walls.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there should not be that many choices.
You can have any. You went TARDIS blue, right?
TARDIS blue.
That's the only color that's acceptable.
That's a nice blue.
It is a nice blue.
It's a deep blue. That's a cool blue.
It's a good blue.
TARDIS blue.
Yep, it's been all over the universe.
It's a little dark for a room, though, I think.
All right, so on the outside of your TARDIS.
Which you paint the doorway TARDIS blue, that would work.
And then, but then inside is your laboratory.
Portal, right.
Yeah. So we're on the set of Star Talk right now, the video version of Star Talk. I'm super excited. You've been wrangling some great talent on the show as well.
Well, I think it's, you know, we've had Morgan Freeman, we've
yep.
had Whoopi Goldberg, we've had, who else we had? We've had...
some names. Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman, thank you. We had Dr. Ruth.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, so Dr. Ruth.
Dr. Ruth.
You had Dr. Ruth.
Yes.
She must be in her...
She was in this chair yesterday.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Was she standing on it? She's wee. She's
I didn't
a wee
know
lady.
If she was standing or sitting. There's no...
no she's a tiny lady.
She's actually quite candid about her height. She's 4'7", in case uh-huh. you were wondering.
Yes.
And a few inches shorter than average, but yep. she's a mighty mo, and it was great. And we talked about... What do you think we talked about?
Space sex?
Yes, that's right.
I'm guessing.
She said that if she ever went into space, and I said, you know, do you want to have, like, sex in zero G? She said, yeah, like, why not? And I said, okay, we can send you there. And she said, oh, plus, if you get permission from your wife, I'll take you with me.
Oh, my God, you were propositioned by Dr. Ruth.
I was so propositioned by Dr. Ruth.
Can I tell you, I think that sleeping with Dr. Ruth is not even, like, cheating. Like, no one could get upset about that. They'd be like, well, of course you have to sleep with her. It's Dr. Ruth. I mean, she's 84. Like, she's...
Right. I mean, you might learn a few things,
you
right?
might
right?
learn, especially from her.
What have two people ever done with sex that she doesn't know about, right? So she's got the...
Listen, all I'm saying is you both study black holes. another interesting... I don't know how to back out of that. That was one step too filthy. But Alan Rickman was on.
Alan Rickman.
I assume you did not talk about space sex with Alan Rickman. How did you... Do you know Alan?
I got people who know people, and I know people, so we got people. What, you don't have people?
I have some people, but I don't have Alan Rickman people.
And I got Alan Rickman, I got people.
What did you guys talk about?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, he's an actor, right?
Yeah.
And he has some interesting science fiction roles.
Sure.
You know, he was in Galaxy Quest.
One of the best.
Wasn't that a crazy movie?
And the fact that it's a comedy and still one of the best sci-fi movies of all time.
Right, right, right. So he's in there, and I got his sort of reaction to that. Got him to chat a little bit about the magic of Harry Potter. He hadn't heard... The Arthur C. Clarke edict about magic. Recite it, please.
I don't know
yes,
it.
Yes, you do know it.
I don't know the Arthur
I will take away your credentials.
Oh, man.
Arthur C. Clarke on magic. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable
from magic.
From magic.
Yes, okay, I do know that. I do know that.
I believe him?
I'm sorry. I did know that, actually.
Okay.
I did know that. Which I always is always an interesting point to me when you Did anyone get crushed by the wall? Did anyone die? All right,
okay.
Good.
We're still rolling, right?
Yeah, we're okay. Still rolling. Let's just do a pickup. Keep going.
Magic. We were just talking about magic. Yeah. But when you start getting into the idea of you know, mythology and religion and science, and then go, well, how do you explain this? It's like, well, maybe we just haven't figured out how to explain it yet.
Well,
so of course it looks like magic now.
Exactly. People always need and want the ready-made explanation. I think most people are uncomfortable with ignorance or uncertainty, whereas you cannot be a research scientist unless you, in fact, embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, you learn to love the questions themselves, because not all answers are in arm's reach.
So do you feel like you...
Either now or perhaps ever.
So do you feel like you don't know anything still?
I am impressed with what I don't know.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
It keeps me going every day.
I loved your quote about, which I'm sure I believe I saw on Reddit, about stupid...
Reddit,
about stupid design, about embracing stupid, like...
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I'm in a few places commenting on it. But what I said was that science is a philosophy of discovery. And in intelligent design is a philosophy of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
It takes something we don't understand, and then you start saying, well, there's a higher intelligence. Well, you didn't really explain it. What you're saying is, I don't understand it, so here's this ready-made explanation that I'm going to apply every time I don't understand something.
Right.
And so I gave evidence of cases where all the world is not intelligent. I mean, it's kind of really stupid, actually.
Yeah.
You know, like, my favorite example is, like, what's going on between our legs? You know?
Yeah.
you got this like sewage system mixed with an entertainment complex, you know? It's like no engineer would have designed that at all, okay? So other things, you know, you got tsunamis and earthquakes and hurricanes and tornadoes and Earth wants to kill us.
Yeah.
People say, oh, Earth is a haven for like, no, it's not. No. No. 70% of the places I drop you butt naked on Earth, you're dead 15 minutes later. We create environments for us to thrive in, and we adjust the thermostat so it's within a 3-degree temperature, and we say, oh, isn't Earth perfect for us? No. No.
It took 10,000 years to get to that.
That's what I'm saying, to earn that thermostat.
Yeah.
And so no, Earth is not a... No, the universe is messed up. And they talk about the order of the cosmos. Yeah, tell that to the dinosaurs as they watch the asteroid hit them. Yeah, the order of their death.
Yeah.
They and 70% of all the species of life on Earth at that time went extinct.
Well, I love the idea. I've always said that the human body is a bad design, that it's like, and this is a gross example, but I use like, the fact that we have to wipe our asses is a bad design. Like that's inefficient.
I have a worse design.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't mind wiping my ass.
Okay.
What I mind is, I breathe, eat, and drink through the same hole in my body. Guaranteeing, because this is a species property, guaranteeing that some percent of humans will choke to death every single year.
Right.
Now, that's an easy problem to solve. Dolphins eat and breathe through two different holes in their body. Mm-hmm. No dolphin ever choked on a ham sandwich trying to breathe.
No. And at an all-you-can-eat salad bar, like a dolphin, you can't compete with them because people have to stop to breathe.
Constantly.
They're just breathing and eating at the same time.
There it is.
Never take one to like a Sizzler. You'll go broke.
We could die. Mm-hmm. So some other things. So for example, we live 80 years, but in 8 weeks of no food, you're dead. Mm-hmm. In 8 days of no water, you're dead. 8 minutes of no air, you're dead. Yet we live 80 years. Yet all these things can kill us in these short periods of time. So we set up the system so that we don't die.
Right.
Just think about that. The whole system is so that we don't die. So that
true.
We can try to live out at least most of these 80 years.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
To try to learn as much as we can in that amount of time. To tell the next people, like, oh, here's a bunch of shit we figured out. Good luck.
So that you and here's what we figured out so you don't die.
Right.
Right.
Here's how you guys cannot die.
Right, exactly.
We'll try to invent these pills so you cannot die some more.
Exactly. Now, talk about dying. Can I give you a spooky thought?
Yes.
Go back to 1900 and ask take a poll.
Okay. Hey, everyone. Here we are back in 1900. Sure looks great.
What are you most afraid of dying from? And people gave a list. It was like famine. Tuberculosis, what else?
Jack the Ripper.
So that list did not include killer asteroids.
No.
It didn't include viruses. It didn't include so many things today we would list that we fear for our lives. And so that leaves you wondering, in the year 2100, what would that list look like?
Oh, God.
What could be the causes of death in that century that we have yet to even dream of? And they'll look back and say, oh, how quaint, they were afraid of asteroids. We just have our little defense system here. That's not even a problem. What they don't know about is this.
Right.
So I stay awake at night wondering, what could kill me that I've yet to dream of?
Oh, that's so mind-bendy. That's mind-bendy and horrifying at the same time.
That's the best kind of mind-bend. The kind that keeps you, I stay awake at night. And I want everyone else to stay awake at night, too, trying to resolve this. These are the unknown unknowns.
How important, because obviously the episode of the TV show that I'm going to put this in is all about science.
Science rocks.
Science rocks. I think anyone who listens to this show or watches the show would tend to agree with you.
To be scientifically literate is to empower yourself to know when someone else is full of shit.
Right.
Can I say that?
Yeah, yeah, you can swear. Swear a lot. It's fine.
When someone else is full of doo-doo.
Yeah.
You have an understanding of the properties of the laws of physics, so someone comes up to you and tries to sell you crystals, and they say, oh, rub these together and you'll be healed. And you just say, well, what are they made of? And how many people have they healed? And what ailments do they heal? And what is the mechanism? And how much do they cost? And where are they from? And what is the molecular structure? The person runs away in tears. Because the science literacy is not knowing the answer. You might know the answer, but that's not what's fundamental. What's fundamental is the capacity to inquire about what is true and what is not in this world. Mm-hmm. And that is the empowerment, the power of inquiry.
Do you feel like we have to fully understand something to believe it?
No. Dark matter, for example, mm-hmm. we don't understand that worth a damn. But we measure it. We measure the effect. If you can measure it, it's a contender.
Okay.
It's something you must reckon. And there's a famous quote by Logan Clendenning who said, no science achieves maturity without first developing a system of measurement.
Oh, yes.
And think about that. Look at how immature, for example, the field of psychology is, mm-hmm. especially clinical psychology. There's no system of measurement. Yeah, how are you going to measure someone's depression? Maybe, oh, is it 0 to 10? I mean, they just never had the systems of measurement. And so now we have whole hospitals filled with mental patients. So with physics has the benefit of many centuries of thinkers that have preceded modern day. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, well, I can tell you within a second what time the sun is going to rise tomorrow, when you're going to have an eclipse, and when the moon changes phases, and even the trajectory of that asteroid that could have our name on it. I have the power to do that. And so science is the ones that have progressed the farthest are those that early established ways of measuring phenomena that they care about.
What was it that you told me earlier about the eclipse? You said it's actually a misnomer.
Oh, it's a geeky thing.
Yeah.
But it's stupidly
it's a fun geeky thing.
Oh,
though.
Okay. So it crosses the fun threshold.
This is the fun threshold.
Okay.
Because I said, oh look. You just eclipsed, I made some comparison to you eclipsing someone, and you said, well, technically.
Yeah. So an eclipse is one object passing into the shadow of another object.
Okay.
That's an eclipse. So a lunar eclipse is the moon moving into Earth's shadow in space. Mm-hmm. We cast a huge conical shadow, and it's always there. You don't know it's there until something lit up goes into it, mm-hmm. and then it disappears. So that's an eclipse. Whereas when the moon comes around to this side and passes between us and the sun is not being blocked by a shadow. The sun is being blocked by an object. Mm-hmm. And that's called an occultation, officially.
An occultation.
Occultation. So a solar eclipse is not really an eclipse. It's an occultation.
So, but
occultation is one object goes in front of the other. It's a technicality, but I don't fault anybody. It's not like Jim Cameron when I got on his case about the wrong sky.
Right.
It's not that bad. We use it. It's a solar eclipse. It's traditional. I won't fault you for it.
So the song should have been Total Occultation of the Heart.
That's exactly.
Technically.
Yeah, think about it.
Nothing
total blockage.
Say, total occultation of the, like, it really doesn't fit the meter that well, though.
I think occultation has a kind of rhythm to it. Occultation. So had they started with the word occultation, a different rhyme would have come out.
What was the Lionel Richie song you guys were trying to figure out?
I don't know. No, I won't even admit that we were trying to sing Lionel Richie an hour ago.
I think it was All Night Long. Was that the one?
No. It was, what was it? The Hello?
Oh,
it's
Hello.
Me. Is that how it goes? Yeah.
Is it me you're looking for? I can see it in your eyes. Yeah, it's the one with the blind girl who makes the sculpture.
That was, oh my gosh! Yeah,
out of his Adelina Rich's face.
One of the forgettable videos.
But they love each other so much. They love each other so much. Is it me you're looking for? Kind of messed up to say, is it me you're looking for to a blind lady?
Well, this is what I'm saying. I don't know who thought up that premise.
Not cool, Lionel Richie.
You look at that and you say, now I know why they don't play videos anymore. It's like, these are the examples of why they don't.
Well, people stopped watching videos. Like there was a period in the early to mid 80s where it was like, music videos.
You had to.
Was a harsh decline, and that's why MTV started putting on television, like programming shows, because people just got over music videos pretty quickly, and they just didn't watch them that much anymore.
Wait, but you have the rest of all your channels to watch shows, so I'm still surprised.
Mm. No, the music video shows were the lowest rated shows on television at the time. And that's why they started doing game shows and programming and all contests and stuff, was because people actually stopped watching music videos in the mid-80s.
It's weird that some switch got turned to make that happen.
I guess when you first see that, like, a place where music videos are aggregated, you go, what an amazing idea. And then after a while, you're like, these are the same 10, how many times can I be surprised?
You know what music videos did? It completely changed the natural edit length mm-hmm. of what you're accustomed to seeing. If you look at videos, if you look at 1980 video,
yeah,
there are long 2-minute cuts in that video. 1 minute, now it's 3 seconds at yeah. most. Seconds.
Well, our attention spans, do you think we could ever go back? Or do you think attention spans are just ruined forever?
I think it's ruined forever. I think it is. Now you can't look at something, because we're visually stimulated. That's what feeds us. And so, what do you do? Do you ever stare at the same thing for a minute? No, you're looking around like this. So I think it is a property of the fact that you get a lot of information quickly in one glance. And then I'm done. Let me get another glance.
Yeah.
And so the video version of that is have a cut, the 3-second cut.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long do you have to look at Paula Abdul's butt? Okay. You get 3-second view, you go on to the next shot.
Yeah.
Or Madonna. I mean, it's there.
Actually, for me, it's 76 seconds.
Oh, you tied that.
Yeah, 76 seconds.
Did you actually use that word?
But
in as much
is that not a, is that is that
no I tweeted,
in so far as
I, yeah I tweeted recently about words that just have too many words in them.
In as much.
Nevertheless.
In as much. Yeah.
There's a bunch of words like this, and what concerns me is the poor word a lot. People say that's 2 words. Damn it! No, come on. Don't tell me nevertheless is 1 word, but I can't glue together and lot.
Sorry, that's the way it is.
Yeah, I don't buy that. So yeah. I'm going to start a lot movement.
Insofar as nevertheless as much, I guess that you
have... Heretofore, we have...
Heretofore with her as well to the...
Yeah, a lot! Don't you feel sympathy for her?
Oh, it's the Pluto of word
the
combos.
Word.
Yeah. Well, it's a... We'll call it a dwarf phrase.
It's a multi-word wannabe.
It no, is.
Okay. But I interrupted. I'm sorry.
You must be at least this tall to ride this word ride. I guess it's just the idea that you you have this quest to promote science, and that it is a difficult, it's surprisingly difficult quest in 2012. Whereas, you know, we always had this vision of the future as like, oh, people will be more enlightened and people will be more this and we'll all understand science a lot better. And I feel like a lot of people just willfully reject it anyway. I think even worse now than even like 20 years ago.
You know what we have to do? We have to compel people to be embarrassed for not knowing about science.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only way to do it. Then they'll come to it on their own.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're beating them over the head, and you know that's no fun for either side.
No, but you have. But so you have. You know, like you have people who haven't learned science yet. You have science deniers, and then also this like weird pseudoscience movement as well of people that frame nonsense in ways that sound scientific, right. But actually, it's a facade for an empty house.
I'm thinking of the '60s when we're going to the moon. It was hard for someone to rise up with the strong pseudoscience posture back then, because science, technology, and engineering was delivering to you in the pages of the daily papers the fruits and benefits of being scientifically literate.
Mm-hmm.
You had no place to stand back then.
Yeah.
It was writ large on the headlines. And now, what headlines, are there any science headlines? Well, I guess there are. You know, the particle accelerator in Europe, but it's not here, right?
Right.
So... is there anything else? No, it's bad economy headlines every day. So I say, let's go to Mars, or go to stop that asteroid headed our way, or let's go hang out on the moon. That mining story about asteroids, that took some headlines. That got
that
some
was
headlines.
A very interesting the idea of basically of shifting to a culture of space miners, where
yes.
we locate all of these asteroids.
Here we are killing each other because your left butt cheek is over a reservoir of oil.
Yeah.
Or some kind of
that
rare
oil did
metal.
Not come from my body, by the way. That was there when I sat down. I just want to be clear about that.
The iron drop, the iron deposit.
Was, yeah, it was already there.
So you get this, and what are we doing here? I'd be embarrassed if an alien landed, they say, hey, how, where are you getting your resources? Well, we're killing each other over this line in the sand because we dig it out of the earth.
Yeah.
Well, how are you getting your energy? We're digging that out of the earth, too. I'd be embarrassed. I say, alien, you know, give us another 100 years. Maybe we'll figure this one out. Don't you get it from the sun? How about the minerals and the asteroids? How about the, you know, asteroids? You know why you get minerals and asteroids? Asteroids are fragments of planets that never stayed whole. They want to become a planet in the early solar system. They're molten. They're gaseous first and then perhaps molten. When you're molten, heavy things fall to the middle. Light things float. Then you freeze. You freeze it out.
Okay.
Freeze meaning it solidifies.
Sure.
So now it already did the filtering for you. It already did the sifting. So now another body comes in, smashes it, and I have chunks of asteroid that are hewn from the core of a planet that never made it. And it's got all the heaviest ingredients there. You got your iron, which we got here in plenty. But all the rest of the heavy elements are concentrated there. Iridium, platinum, gold, osmium, tungsten. All these precious metals that we use in industry and in the military. It's all there. They're chunks of rocks sitting out there waiting to be kissed.
That are flying by the earth.
Flying by the earth. And we're still here. Excuse me. I got to pull this out of the ground. I can't begin to tell you how primitive that activity is.
How far off do you think we are from space mining?
A zillion years. No.
Ah, crap.
No. I 50 years, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was in the airport the other day, and there was a guy. The guy in front of me in the security line, it was the weirdest thing I've ever heard at a security line, where everyone's taking all their laptops out, and he puts a bunch of stuff into the bin, and then he says to the TSA officer, "I just want to let you guys know I have a lot of tungsten here," and and it was weird, A, that he pointed it out, B, that he thought that they would think anything of it, and C, why does someone carry a lot of tungsten around? What is the purpose of carrying tungsten around?
Well, tungsten has a very high melting point, so that's why it's the filament of choice in light bulbs.
Okay.
Yeah.
But why would this guy have a bunch of tungsten just
loose? I'm not authorized to say.
Oh, all right. Oh. Dead.
Tungsten's cool. No, I once carried a meteorite through security, and I thought, should I declare it in advance? And I did this coincidentally on the anniversary of September 11th, 2002, in Dulles Airport outside of Washington. I have a meteorite. I have a 15-pound meteorite. It's in a box. And I thought, do I call in advance and prepare? Then I thought that would call too much attention to it, and then they'd get spooked. So I said, I'll just go up there with the meteorite.
I mean, it probably just looks like a rock that you bought at a museum, you know, like at a store, right? No?
No. This is a metallic meteorite, which would be opaque to X-rays.
Oh.
This is a blob thing that they cannot see through going through the air. So I just put it there, walked through, and I said, excuse me, what's in this box? I said, oh, it's just a meteorite. I said, I was just as cool as can be. And then one person recognized me. Said, hey, you're the guy from the museum with the space? And I said, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's cool. And they all crowded around and looked at the meteorite and they touched it. And so it was a scene, but I got it through.
When they all touched it, you go, you're all mutants now.
You're
not supposed to touch that. Is there any fear of space mining and bringing any kind of particle? Yeah, anything back to Earth that shouldn't be here.
The Andromeda strain.
Right, exactly. Exactly, the Andromeda strain.
I'm not authorized to.
Damn it! Damn it!
They could be. I mean, they did this with the Apollo astronauts. They came back from the moon. They quarantined them. And they studied, see if there are any moon bugs that came with them. And that was kind of cool. But I kept thinking, wait a minute. The capsule that came from the moon splashed down in our ocean.
Oh, yeah.
Then you fish them out of the water. Now you put him in a quarantine.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little late, I think. You know. But they found no bugs, nothing, you know, no known life. The moon, we wouldn't expect it to have, like, thriving organics.
Right.
So our expectations were fulfilled. You know.
It'd be pretty amazing to, this website, IO9, just recently had an article about
how
stuff about me shows up there every now and then.
Sam, maybe you pop up there a little bit.
Every
from
now
time
and then,
and time.
It shows up. Hey, yeah.
Yeah, you're very popular. I don't know if you know this or not, but you're
no,
very popular.
I don't
popular.
Think about it. I just try to do my thing.
Yeah, but IO9 had a story about yes, Star Trek did inspire a lot of things that became a reality in terms of communicators and whatnot, and inspired a generation of people. But most of it was wrong. And the first example was. Spaceships. We don't have. We are not a spaceship culture. There's no. We don't. It's
example number one.
There's no spaceship. Way to travel from point A to distant point B. You know, just the logistics that would be involved. So there are now these theories like, no, if we travel, if there is interstellar travel, it's basically like we're gonna have to upload our personalities onto a cube and send it.
The fastest piece of hardware we've ever sent is in. Motion now to Pluto.
Yeah.
The first rule of scientific experiments are you get your results before you die. Okay, so Pluto is very far away. I have my colleagues that are working on Pluto. Yeah. It's their whole suite of launch vehicles where it would get there in 2030, 2040. It said, no, give me your biggest engines. But now you have to make the payload small. So the big engines propel something small. So it was small craft, big engines. It passed the moon in like 6 hours. I mean, the thing was booking. Oh, my gosh. It was hauling. And so it'll get to Pluto in 3 years now. So,
3 years?
Well, 3 years from now. Yeah, it was launched about 5 years ago. Yeah.
What are some of the best images that we have of Pluto so far?
Hubble telescope was getting the best ones. But as this thing gets closer, it'll get better and better and better. So, but it's still this, it has very a big contrast between light and dark. So there's still it's still a mystery.
I mean, is it?
And just so you know. I'm on you. I'm ahead of you. Don't at the end of it say. So does that mean Pluto should still be a planet?
No, I wouldn't dare.
Okay.
We covered this the last time.
That's
you were
what I'm
on.
Saying. That's
we
what
covered
I'm saying.
This last time you were on. But is there anything, you know, as we get better, higher resolution images of you know planets in our solar system, or even data from distant stars? I mean, are we still discovering shocking things about these bodies, or is it sort of confirming or within the neighborhood of things we thought we understood?
We have some expectations. Let me tell you the biggest shocker of them all. We go look for planets that don't orbit our sun, mm-hmm. exoplanets,
yep.
and we say, okay, we have our solar system. We must be representative of all solar systems. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not? It's actually called the Copernican principle.
All right.
Noting that you're not special. Okay. That's the.
What a great way to tell someone their kid's not special. He's the Copernican
it's
principle.
It's the Copernican principle. Yeah. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That sounds fancy. Yeah,
yes. You're chances are you're average. All right. but it's true. The Earth is not the biggest or the smallest planet. The sun is not the hottest. It's not the coldest. It's not the biggest. It's not the smallest.
We're the porridge Goldilocks.
We're in a suburban arm in the galaxy, in an ordinary galaxy.
Yeah.
It nothing special. Okay? So we go to look for other solar systems, other star systems, and what we find are big Jupiters orbiting really close to the host star. We had come up with theories of the formation of star systems that would sort of look like ours.
Sure.
If we are at some metric of what is mm-hmm. in the cosmos. And so the planets were in all places that we could not understand. We had to invent a whole new theory of star formation and star system formation to account for that.
Is that exciting to a group of scientists when they go, holy crap, we get to come up with this whole new...
Yes! We are seduced by ignorance. Because therein are the places where new ideas can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
We're called to it.
And is that what we need to be instilling into people, is the idea of discovering new ideas instead of clinging to old, comfortable ones?
No, because new ideas are rare. You have to have them embrace the quest.
Okay.
Because that quest doesn't always land on a new idea, but the quest will always be interesting. Because you learn things, you learn ways to not do things.
Sure.
That's the famous quote from Thomas Edison. I'll mess it up if I try to get it exactly, but it was something like, you know, he tried all these different materials to figure out what he should use for the filament of his Edison light bulb. Finally lands on tungsten.
Can I take a guess to make up for the Arthur C. Clarke one? It was something to the effect of, I didn't fail 99 times. I learned 99 ways to not make a light bulb. Was it something like that?
It was. We'll give you B+.
Okay. Good. 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 At least I proved that I was in the neighborhood.
You're in the hood.
Okay. What was the
in the geek hood?
What was the actual quote?
No. It was close to that. It was whatever was the number.
Yeah.
They said, "Don't you feel bad about all this time you wasted just to find tungsten?" And he says, no, I didn't waste the time. I found, you know, 99 ways to not, you know, I find 99 objects that do 99.
But a bitch ain't one.
Nobody? Really? Just, I'm the only J-Z. Sorry.
99 elements that will not work in a light bulb. So that's the slow way to get to the result. Usually you need sort of a theory of understanding.
Sure.
So that you can be pre-selective.
Yeah.
You don't want to just randomly go through the lab. I mean.
I love the idea of Edison, too. And I just because I think some people have a sense of, like, he wasn't just one guy working by himself. And, it, like, he had a team of people.
A huge.
That were constantly.
Huge.
Yeah. Almost like an artist colony of scientists.
Yes, exactly. And they were under his guidance, and he had certain ideas, and he had the funding, and he paid their salaries. So, but yeah. I mean, maybe Steve Jobs today was like that.
I tried to make that comparison to Steve Jobs to Edison, and someone's like, you're full of shit. And I'm like, no. He didn't design the iPhone. He hired the right people to carry out his vision.
Correct.
He had a vision, and he put the architects in place.
So why are they saying they don't like your analogy?
I don't know. I don't know, because some people...
So slap him.
I wouldn't
go on to the next person.
Neil, if I took the time to slap everyone online that I wanted to slap, I would be in the slapping business, and I would have to give up everything else that I do, because there's no shortage of people you want to slap online. And I don't even know how someone in your position who probably gets, you know, as much as you have supporters, you also probably have violent detractors who want to tell you how wrong and awful of a person you are when you just say something very simply that you have discovered. And I don't know how do you
get around that. I hardly ever express an opinion.
Oh, that's good.
No, think about that. And so I'll give you an example, a perfect example. I am quoted as saying, God is an ever-receding pocket of scientific ignorance. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Dude, somebody put that on a t-shirt, signed Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah.
Now, that sounds audacious, right? Just getting out there in the ring. But that's incomplete. That's not actually the full thing that I said. I said, if God is the frontier of what we yet understand in the universe to you, then God is an ever-receding pocket of scientific ignorance.
Oh, okay.
Okay? There's not an opinion in that sentence. That is an if-then statement.
A conditional clause.
A conditional clause. And so, given that, what's important there is, there are people who say, they ask me, what was before the universe? I don't know. That was God. They say, well, what is dark matter? I said, I don't know. Well, that's the spirit of God. Yeah, so they're jumping into the sort of the God of the gaps mode. And I say, if that's what God is to you, then God is a ever-receding pocket of scientific ignorance. And so if you take only half that quote, it looks like I'm handing you my opinion.
Right.
But in fact, with the if-then clause, it is true no matter what. And what it does is you cannot then argue with me, because that's not a me statement. It's a logically constructed sentence, and you might have issues with the sentence, but you can't have issues with me. That's the point here.
Yeah.
So I hardly ever express opinions.
That's really interesting.
I'll give you another one. You know, I have a book that just came out recently about space exploration.
Uh-huh.
And people say, oh, I'm on a hobby horse trying to get people interested in space. No. I'm trying to get you to understand why, if you're not interested in space, it will undermine the stability of your economy. And then I present that argument. So at the end of the day, you take ownership of your understanding of the causes and effects of things, and it doesn't even require reference back to me, because it is an enlightened position that you now have that you didn't have before.
Interesting.
So that's why I don't get attacked. I really don't.
Good.
It sounds like you get attacked all the time.
Constantly.
I don't get attacked because, as an educator, it's not about me. It's never about me. It's about the knowledge and wisdom of the natural world and how your knowledge and wisdom of that can empower you to make decisions that you take ownership of. So I'm duty-bound as a scientist and as an educator to share this information with you. What you do with it after that in a free society, that's your business. I don't lobby Congress. I don't lead marches. I don't give speeches at rallies. Because that implies you want people to do what you do and to say what you say. I never care about that. All I want people to do is be enlightened. And then they vote for whoever the hell they want.
Yeah.
And in a free society, you have the right to do that. I don't talk to members. I get invited in, but I don't seek to influence members of Congress because they're duly elected from some base of voters. Why should I do an end run on the wishes of those voters? And then, so suppose I even influence that member of Congress. Then 2 years later, they're voted out, someone else comes. I got to go back and influence another one? Isn't it more efficient to enlighten the electorate in the first place? Because they're there every 2 years. So for me, the goal is a smarter country. For me, the goal is people who can think for themselves.
How do we achieve that? I guess if we knew that, it wouldn't be a problem.
Right. Well, you think for yourself not by telling them what to think, but by training them how to think.
Sure. Yeah, well, we certainly don't... I mean, if you look at the education system, a lot of it doesn't really train kids how to think necessarily. It's like, here's...
Not at all. It's like, here's the lesson plan, learn it, you tested on it, there it is.
Yeah, I mean, I know that when I was younger, and I'd be in, like, English class or whatever, and they'd say, well, like, for instance, conditional, well, this is a conditional clause, and I go, okay, I guess that's a conditional clause. And it wasn't until I went to high school and studied Latin that I went back, and then I really understood, oh, this is why these things are the way they are, and that's what that means, and that's...
Now you take ownership of the knowledge.
Yeah, exactly, and it's you kind of feel like, oh, I get it now, rather than just, I'm regurgitating a bunch of shit
right.
I heard.
Right, right, that's the difference between... That's the difference. People think you go to school so that they can fill your mind, but it really, a proper training turns an empty mind into an open mind.
But as much as people are addicted to comfort and I think holding on to old ideas, I think there's such a
addicted
chemical...
Addicted to comfort, I like that.
They are addicted to comfort.
Do you hear the contrast between the British and the French? Have you ever heard that one?
No.
It's the British spend money on comforts, but that same money, when spent by the French, is spent on pleasures. And if you look at the two cultures, there it is.
Yeah.
You know. The British, he's got the cigar and the sherry and the comfortable chair. In France, they have the wine, the food, the debauchery.
Yeah.
So how you spend your time. Yeah.
But also, there's such a chemical reward for learning things and understanding things. And it's like, how do we, you know, almost be like, you have to trick people en masse with their own physiology of like, here, see, this actually feels
like
good.
The chemical reward concept, because that's how you felt. Whatever chemistry coursed in your body and your mind when you took Latin and figured out what that other thing meant, mm-hmm. something changed in you. It felt good, didn't
it? Yeah, of course.
No, it didn't just feel good, it felt good. It
felt really good.
Good. So that's the aha moment. And I think we all have that capacity and that power. And so as the educator, I try to seek to instill an aha moment in whoever will listen. But sometimes you can create something that they are drawn to, and then you don't have to beat them over the head. That's the kind of electorate I want. And that electorate will ensure that tomorrow is a more advanced state of the nation than today.
Yeah.
It will become their prime directive.
Well, you know, when some states are talking about, you know, teaching, like... Like intelligent design, or is it?
Well, education is local. Education is a local thing. Education is not stipulated in the Constitution. And whatever's not stipulated there is under control of the states. So states control education. The government cannot tell you what to teach in your schools. They can advise it, but they can't tell you. They can't force it. And they don't. So, some school districts will teach whatever they want. And if they don't teach what you want, people take the kids out of school and homeschool them. Mm-hmm. The largest growing sector of homeschoolers is the religious community that doesn't want their kids to learn about evolution. That's the largest growing sector of homeschoolers. So, you can go in there and try to argue and scream. I'm just saying, let's just offer what being scientifically literate can do for you and let people recognize that on their own. I think that's the kinder, gentler solution. But I think in the end, it's the only solution that will actually work. Because a person has to be self-motivated to want to know it, to want to learn it, and to want to be it.
Yeah, so maybe rather than teaching knowledge, we need to be teaching people how to be self-motivated.
Well, yeah, or that's the insight, impart insight, or light a flame where they want to go learn more about that subject. Oh, yeah.
I know that I just saw an announcement today that Harvard and MIT released a bunch of, they're releasing free courses online where you can actually get you can actually get a Harvard or MIT education through online courses.
Yeah, I mean, and you'll find out it's the same damn course you could have gotten at the local. No, Physics 101 in Harvard is Physics 101 in, you know, Oshkosh Community College.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole, you know, most of what you do learn in college are standard textbooks. So, you know, I think there's elite schools are overrated in what you can actually end up learning when you just have access to the same textbooks that they have.
Right. Yeah, I guess that really was the big dividing line in the old days. Of like, you literally had to have the physical knowledge in books in place. And now it's like, well, boy, I could learn about thermal dynamics by looking at my phone.
Exactly. Exactly. That's the great scene in Good Will Hunting.
Oh, where he say, where he totally slaps that kid down at the bar with
he bitch slaps him. It was like, yes.
Yeah, I'm just a I'm just a janitor who happens to be super smart. Yeah, I'm super smart. So what? You spent $100,000.
$100,000 you could have gotten a library card and late charges.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. P.S. I'm also a math genius, and you're not a math genius, but you could have, you know. Otherwise, it's fine. I just met Bill Nye the other night.
He's my guy.
He's awesome.
He's my boy.
Oh my God, he's so awesome.
Right. In fact, he's coming to town this weekend. We'll be chilling with him, having dinner
with him. I love Bill Nye. He came to we had a Nerdist Channel launch party, and Bill Nye and I came, and there were other celebrity types there, and Bill Nye was the guy that got the moat. Like, I'm surprised that people didn't rip him apart, like, just trying to touch him and take pictures. And it made me feel like we're doing the right thing when we have a party to represent the things that we're doing and working and caring about. And Bill Nye is the guy that gets the most attention.
There it is.
That was a nice thing.
He walks
for
down
me.
The street, there are like legions of people following him.
They just start following him, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Are you guys working together on stuff?
We collaborate. Executive director of the Planetary Society.
Yep.
The society founded by Carl Sagan 32 years ago.
Yep.
And I'm on the board, so I have many occasions to. We have a board meeting in Washington on Monday.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
He's coming through town. We're going to hang out before then.
Anything fun things coming up at the Hayden Planetarium?
Actually, I'm on a kind of sabbatical now doing these other projects. But the attendance is going gangbusters. New York City is almost like a tourist renaissance now.
Good.
The tourism is at an all-time high in New York, actually. International tourism as well. And they go to all the fun museums, and so we see them every time. Now there's like accents and languages that never used to be there when I was growing up as a kid. So the city's doing well. The museums are doing well. And my book came out just exactly two months ago on space exploration, and it's put some buzz out there just to get us back on a frontier that I think we long lost sight of. So it's been keeping me off the streets.
Well, you're a very powerful voice in not just science, but also in promoting science education, and I think it's very important. And I cannot tell you how excited I am when I tell people that we're doing Star Talk as a video show on the Nerdist channel. Like, I leaked it at a show that I was doing, a live show, and I threw out a bunch of names and people clapped, and then I said, and we're going to do Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and it turned into like Def Comedy Jam. Like, I'm not kidding. One guy jumped out of his, he was like, holy shit! Like, and people went bananas. So
I have to live up to that.
You really do. It's a lot of pressure, but I can't thank you enough for letting us put Star Talk on the channel. I'm super excited about it.
Excellent. Well, it's a place. I mean, and my hope is that not only nerds go there, right? I mean, you want to spread the love.
Sure.
And nerds already know who we are.
Sure.
And
sure.
Who we hang out with, and
sure.
Who to recite decimals of pi to. You know. So the real impact will be others recognizing that this is a cool place to be in a cool state of mind and a cool outlook on life, the universe, and everything.
Well, to that I say, 3.14159265358973232843826236432823957126939937510582097449445923078164062862089862803432523421176798628023482538926408654826289862804802538625 I think that's all I know.
Seven.
Shit! That's the equivalent of just dropping a scientific wiener on the table and being like, here you go. Yes, I'm a big fan of pie.
Excellent.
If it wasn't apparent. But to you, I say, enjoy your burrito, which is what we say at the end of our podcasts.
Okay.
Yeah. You know what? It basically means enjoy the process. That's exactly what enjoy a burrito means. It means don't think about the future, don't think about the past, live in the moment and enjoy the process and enjoy the present.
I'll do that.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again. And you're on my set here.
I know I'm on your set here on Star Talk. It's great.
Yes.
And I'm just bummed that I don't live in New York, so I can't come hang out at more of your tapings.
I'll be hitting L.A. often, so I'm going to pop, pop by uninvited.
Please, 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 please do as much as you want. You're doing Cosmos, right?
Yes, Cosmos. Oh, yeah, it's another project. We got time to talk about that. It's not coming out until 2014.
Okay.
So we got time.
Okay, great. We'll
We're
talk
scripting
about it
now, and it's an honor and a privilege to fill those shoes, or to occupy the shoes held by Carl Sagan to take Cosmos into the future, the 21st century reboot of that landmark television series. So 13 episodes, airing on Fox, by the way.
Oh.
People said, Fox. But they're like a bunch of science nitwits on Fox. That's the most common reaction I get. And I say, well, that's why it belongs on Fox. isn't that how this works? You know,
but there is an interesting thing to say for you, where you kind of like, when you're preaching to your crowd, it's great. But that's a bolder stance of like, no, preach outside the crowd.
Yeah.
Because that's where you're going to really pull people in.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, Neil. Again.
Good to see you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
This is Liam Lynch, and I'm recording live from my home studio with my good friend Steve Agee.
Boo.
So
boo meaning if you, as a ghost, not...
I get it. If you heard me on the Nerdist podcast, I had mentioned a sort of a ghost story. It's more of like a experience than a story with a beginning, middle, and end, but it's still freaky, and I've always wanted to tell it, but... it's not like I'm going to go on Celebrity Ghost Stories and tell this story because, I don't think they'd have the budget to do the reenactments.
Okay, so
I'll just get right into it because this is something that went over many years and it can take a while. I moved to England in 1994 and to study, and I went over there with my mom the first time to find a place to live, and I moved into a building maybe 4 or 5 months before school started. The building had just been renovated, and there was an Irish guy that was the landlord, and he had just gutted the whole building, if you're from Liverpool, he gutted it. So he was a really nice guy from Ireland, and I think because, I'm Irish and my mom looks like a leprechaun, he was charmed and let me move in to be the first person moving into this building. The building, was built in the mid-1700s.
Oh, shit.
And it was above... the building, if you're Google mapping, looking straight down the building, it's shaped like a letter L. And the short part of the L is facing a street. And this was in city center. And it was a place called the Tea Room. And it was a restaurant, like a cafe, that would close at 2 p.m. They served breakfast and tea and stuff, and then they closed at 2. And then the long part of the L went back into an alley. And it was a three-story building. I was on the second floor. And so my apartment was a long hallway. And it was this narrow, super long hallway, and all the rooms were on the right-hand side. There were it looked like a hotel hall with doors only on one side. I moved into this building. I was the only person living in the building. It had just been renovated. I didn't know a lot about paranormal stuff, and that when you renovate some of these old buildings, it stirs things up sometimes. So, school hadn't started. I was just trying to get acclimated to living in England, and let alone a new school and going back to school. And finally, some students came from Japan to visit the school. That they were going to be coming to the school, and I think they were arriving to find their places to live and stuff. And so the school contacted me and said, hey, some other students are coming. If you want to come up to the school, you can meet some of your fellow classmates since you've been waiting around like a year for school to start.
God.
So I went up there and they barely spoke English. I mean, like no English. So we were walking back and I kind of motioned like, come to have tea or, you know, and they, oh, okay, yes. And I went and while we were walking back, I actually got a Japanese... English to Japanese translation dictionary, like a little book, which didn't have all the words, but it helped. So we went back to my apartment and we're in a room that's at the very end of the hallway. And we had our tea and I was like, you know, more tea? And they're like, oh, yes. And so we got our cups and we stood up to go into the kitchen.
Right.
So as we get up, we step into the hallway and... I am not kidding. And I would take lie detectors, anything, truth serums. I believed in ghosts for, I think I believed in the idea of ghosts, but I never had an experience and I didn't really, really believe that that sort of thing could ever happen.
Right.
We walked into the hallway. We all came around the corner and we all gasped. And at the end of the hallway, these walls are white. The carpet is like gray. The door at the end is white. It's like this bright long hallway. At the end of the hallway, near the first door, which would be like a closet door, there is a woman in that was solid black, but you could see she was standing and she was standing near the door, just looking at the door, and she had on a super tight-waisted dress that went down to the floor,
ankles, yeah.
And she had little boots with heels, and it had a boost, like a, is it a, you know, the thing, not a bustier, the thing
bustle
on the back, the back, like where the butt kind of goes out on the back of the skirt, and like in a high collar and her hair up in a bun, but solid standing shadow with detail that you could see clearly, and I'm frozen with absolute terror. And one of the Japanese guys says, "Woman," and then as I'm looking at it, it is just instantly gone. Like, you're staring at something, and then it just disappears. And that's actually what scared me more than the fact this is a ghost or anything. It was to see something that is in front of you disappear, really actually is there, and then is just not there.
Right.
It's hard for your brain to deal with that. And we got tea, and we sat down, and we were all scared. And I was like, you know, he's like, "Woman." I was like, I'm like, okay. And I got paper. I'm like, "Draw what you saw." And we all drew this exact same lady. And so now we're dealing with the dictionary, trying to talk about, holy shit, we just saw a ghost. So later, school starts, months go by. This apartment was extremely cold, and there was no insulation, and you could see your breath in the apartment. My door to my bedroom had about 3 or 4 inch gap between the bottom of the door and the floor. And so I would take a little space heater and put it in my bedroom, and I'd close the door and I'd shove a towel under the door and I'd heat up the room for a few hours before I was going to go to bed. And then I'd take the towel out and I'd turn the heater off and I'd go to bed. I went to bed one night and I'd leave the hallway light on, and I'm just got in bed and I'm laying there and it's like that quiet where you're about to fall asleep, and then I hear,
ugh, fuck.
Not my front door.
Your bedroom
door. My bedroom door.
Fuck.
And I open my, I'm so scared because I think that there's somebody breaking in. But then I realized the front door never opened, and I'm on the second floor, and there's no way to get to my windows, and the windows, you couldn't get in them from the outside, and my front door never opened, and your mind's racing, and then I hear again,
ugh,
like a definite knuckle against the door moving in the frame.
Yeah.
And I look, and I'm like in bed, and I lean up, and I look over the end of my bed, and under the door, there's two black, like, things breaking the light of somebody standing right up against the door. And I'm just quiet, and I've never ever felt that level of terror. Like, I was actually, it was terror.
Yeah.
So I laid there, and I just, like, literally pulled the blankets over my head and curled up, and I was awake all night with my head under the covers. Like, I'd pull the covers open just a little bit so I could get, like, breathe and, like, get some cool breaths of air. And
what,
then I
put eight? Them
in that. Yeah, I was four. Like,
did the knocking keep happening?
No. And then I looked up and the boots aren't there, and I'm like, is this gonna happen the rest of the time living here? So maybe
that.
A month later it happens again. The way this building was, I'd go in a side door on the side of this cafe, and I'd go down a long hall. There was a staircase. You'd go up the staircase at the end, and there was a landing. You'd go up again, and then there's a landing, which was just the door to my apartment.
Right.
And no other people. And then you'd go up and up again to another landing. There was a door, and then there was an apartment above
floor,
me.
Yeah.
And I was still the only person living there. I got some my friends from Norway. I brought them and said, hey, there's open apartments here. It's really nice. You should move in. So I had a friend of mine living upstairs in the apartment, and some Norwegian students living in the flat below mine. So this happened again. I went to bed, a couple knocks on my door, feet standing there.
Ugh.
I'm just standing there.
Dude, what the fuck,
terrorized. I didn't say anything to anybody. In the hallway outside my door on this landing, there was motion sensor. So if I opened my door, the light sensor would come on because it was shone right down where my door was. So any movement made the lights come on, and then they would go off like in 2 minutes or something. So then I'm that same like week, I get this really knocking on my front door. And I'm thinking it's one of my friends. So I'm like, coming. I'm like running down the hallway, and I go to the door, and the door's knocking as I'm approaching it, and I feel it. And I open the handle, and I open the handle up, and it's just a dark stairwell. Which means, I lean my head out to look, and the lights come on as soon as I lean my head out. So. Something,
so there's nobody
something,
there to make the
there's
lights
nobody
go on.
There. It's impossible to step in that hallway without activating the lights. The knocking on the door happened numerous times and scared the hell out of me every time. So then I go down. So then one night this happens with the ghost outside my door. I wake up. I'm super scared. I go over to my bedroom window and I look down. And if you remember, like, the building being shaped like an L, and I'm down towards one end. I can look at the back of the cafe, and I can look through the windows of the cafe. And I'd eat breakfast there every morning. It was just like a little tiny little, you know, cafe place. So it's 3 a.m. I look out my back windows, and the ladies that work at the place, you know, the ladies that work behind the counter are there. And they're just sitting in the dark cafe reading.
What?
At 3 a.m. and they have a little tiny light.
What the fuck, dude?
And I'm like, that scared me so bad because I just got scared by the ghost. And then I look out my window and I look down into an alley, and I'm on the second floor, and I'm looking down to the first floor, catacorner, you know, to my building. And the women are just sitting there in the middle of the night in a closed up cafe with all the lights off, reading. So now I'm freaking out. I go down the next morning. I go down for breakfast, and they're there, and I'm and
oh, no.
and I didn't want to say
what
anything.
You're gonna say. This is really bumming me out.
What? Well, maybe you don't know. Oh, okay. Maybe you do know. I don't know.
No, I haven't heard this story. Okay. I just think I know where this story is
maybe
going.
Maybe not, though. So I play it off. And then next month, I see them again down sitting up all night. I can't figure it out. So then I go down there and I say, hey, do you guys ever have any weird things go on down here? Like, you know, ghost stuff? And they kind of look at each other and they're like, every night we put the chairs up on all the tables and we lock up. And when we come in the morning, the chairs are all down and in the corner.
In the corner.
And she said, and then she said, and yesterday we were down, the kitchen for this restaurant is in the basement. She said, yesterday we were both down in the kitchen getting ready and making food, and a man walked through the kitchen and we thought he was a burglar, and so we ran after him and said, sir, and he walked around the corner and I was walking behind him and he walked right through the wall. He walked right into the wall. And she said, a couple times we've seen this man and he comes, you know, from like an area where there's just like a cooler or something, and he comes around the corner through the kitchen, makes a right, goes out into the hallway, and then there's a wall on the side, and he turns and goes right through into the wall. So, and I just like, can I see where it was? So they take me down to the basement, and when you go into the basement, you realize that this building's from the 1700s. Mm. It feels old. And they show me this wall, and they're like, right here. He came around right around here, and walked right through this wall, and I was like, oh my god. So we're all freaking out about ghost stuff. So then months go by. I'm having the knocking on my front door. I go down to breakfast, and the guy, the Irishman that I rent the apartment from, he's the landlord, comes in. Hello, Liam, how are you doing? And he sits down with me and eats breakfast with me. So then I look at him and I notice he has on a Mason's ring. Uh-huh. And I'm like, okay, so this guy's a Mason. He owns buildings in Liverpool and stuff. Okay, that's interesting. I was like, oh, you're a Mason. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm a Mason. And, you know, my father was and his father. And so now I'm wondering, is there weird Mason stuff going on here? So I nonchalantly ask ladies, you know, this is a couple days later, you know, I was up in the middle of the night and I looked down. I saw you guys were down here. I was like, were you guys, why, what were you guys doing? You were both sitting there reading at like 3 a.m. And they look at each other and they're like, well, and then like they're like kind of quiet and they're like, our, you know, the man that owns the building has the Masons meet here. It's a Mason meeting place.
They meet in 3 a.m?
They meet. They have all night secret meetings in the basement of this building.
See, I thought you were going to say they
weren't. And so the women
weren't really there.
Oh, they were there. They were serving tea for all the Masons, but they're not allowed in the meeting. So they're sitting upstairs waiting in case those guys need any tea or anything. So I'm like, okay, that's weird. So then I talk to them about the ghost, and I find out that this building used to be a hugely famous in Liverpool horror house.
Nice.
And but not like, you know, because it was a port town. It was the richest port in all of England. Mm-hmm. And this was for a place that government officials, like sailors, weren't going through there. These were like really expensive
dignitaries.
Yeah, dignitaries, like really beautiful, educated women that would be with these, you know, government officials and people that could afford them. So they, this woman owned the building. And if you guys are like a woman owning a whole building in a city, she was really smart. She's probably like a Heidi Fleiss type of woman. And she owned this place. And so then it started clicking in my head that this was her building. And what is she doing? I'm seeing her outside doors, knocking on doors. She was a madam. So she was probably making rounds where she'd listen into rooms and not give a tap on doors to check in on her girls in the rooms. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and the woman that we saw in the hallway looked like she was from that time, and she was standing outside a door listening. And so it was like these knocks. So my friend Stein that lives upstairs started, he was, you know, he's this really crazy guy, and he was very loud. And I would go up to his floor, and we're in his hallway, and there's a knock at the door. I open the door, no one there. Again, just like in my apartment. And he's like hanging up all these pictures in the hallway and being really loud. And one of the times we're up there, we're sitting there talking, and all of a sudden we hear this loud bang, and the hammer, which he had just set down, it was the sound of it landing in the, going down the stairs and landing down on the landing of the staircase. Like the hammer flew down the hallway and out the door,
right,
and was down the hallway. Then he would come into his apartment and take off his shoes, and he was being really loud and playing music and stuff. And I actually went up to say, "Hey man, can you turn it down a little bit?" And while I'm in his apartment, the door opens and I hear all this sound, and all of his shoes are out in the hall. Like, and I imagine that, I don't know this for a fact, but I imagine if they were kicking someone out, they'd probably grab the guy's boots and throw him out in the hall, because you have to go out to get your boots or something. It just seemed really strange. So then the other layer to this story and all these paranormal things that are occurring is that one day I'm eating breakfast down there, and these people from the college, there's a college across the street, John Moores University, and there's a graveyard across the street as well. And the people from John Moores came over, and they were saying, "Excuse me, we're studying the Williamson tunnels, and we've been doing like seismic mapping of Liverpool and everything. And apparently, there was a Mason, and he privately funded just miles and miles of secret underground tunnels through the entire city that the Masons would use."
No way.
And they had carved out ballrooms. They had all this stuff under the city. He never asked anybody. He just did it. And some of the entrances that this team had found were in the center of train tunnels. You walk into a train tunnel really far, one stone on the side is lever is balancing on a center point, and if you turn it, it would rotate and lead you into a secret tunnel. One of the entrances they found was in the graveyard across the street in one of the tombs. You could go into the tomb and slide back the, you know, the tomb lid, and there were stairs going down. I mean, it's like video game shit. They were like, "We, you know, a lot of the tunnels are filled in with rubble and debris, or the streets would collapse." And the guy said, "One of the tunnels we believe leads to your basement." And we go down. Oh, I go down there with them.
Fuck.
It's the spot in the wall where the dude,
entrance.
That was where the entrance was. Exactly where they saw the ghost go right through. So it basically, ghost Masons still. And it was so that the Masons, without being seen, because they're all important men in the town, without being seen, could go to the whorehouse. So they were meeting in the basement of the whorehouse, using secret tunnels, coming from all different areas of town, secretly moving under the streets, coming to the whorehouse, having their meetings in this basement, where they're still having them today. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, blew my brain out. So
Literally. That's
basically the story. But anything that has ghosts, whores, and secret tunnels,
I'm in.
Yeah,
me too. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was definitely crazy. What was really crazy was this story happening over time and unraveling with just constant getting the shit scared out of me by really paranormal things happening. I can't remember the woman's name right now, but I later, when I learned what her name was, she came to the door, knocked on my bedroom door again. I actually talked to her and I said to her, I know this is your building. Thank you for letting, I'm just staying here. Like, I know about you and I respect you. Like, I was like basically saying what I would say if the woman was in front of
Please
me.
Please don't knock on my
yes,
door.
Yes, exactly. But I basically, like, I talked to her and I could see her feet. She stayed outside my door the entire time I spoke. So she never said anything. I never heard her voice, but she was visual and she could definitely move and interact with solid objects because she was throwing shoes in the hall. She was knocking on doors and I don't know why. She obviously came right through my front door without it needing to open. So
no thanks.
So that's all, folks. Good night. Think about ghosts.
Sleep well.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast Smartless has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome the dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!